President Trump takes a dramatic step to fight the coronavirus.
To unleash the full power of the federal government in this effort today, I am officially declaring a national emergency.
As the numbers go up, people everywhere around the world are staying home, but millions of Americans can't afford to.
The United States is a complete outlier in lacking all forms of paid sick leave.
And lawmakers in Canada conducted a grand economic experiment. Give people free cash.
One of the interesting things was people adopted better lifestyles. So people smoked less and they drank less.
Also, Italians sing away their sorrows into the empty streets of Siena. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. President Trump addressed the nation and world this afternoon. He declared a national emergency to allow more direct relief to Americans affected by the spread of the coronavirus. The president has faced some intense criticism for his response so far. I asked The World's Alana Gordon what gets triggered now that the president has declared a national emergency.
I mean, practically speaking, Marco, it's to free up funding and allow even more support to local communities to really try to get a handle and get ahead of this coronavirus. Already, you know, the White House has gotten a lot of flack for the delays in testing and has been talking about speeding that up, partnering now with private organizations to make those more available soon. As we already heard last week, Congress and President Trump signed a law that enacts over $8 billion in funding to deal with coronavirus, but this allows that to even scale up even more. And it all comes right now at a time this evening at 11:59 p.m. when there's supposedly going to be new screening protocols at airports for any citizens coming back from Europe. And in addition to that, those who are not from the United States and are in Europe won't be allowed entry for 30 days.
Yeah, I know the coronavirus cases have been growing in Europe, but why the intense focus on Europe now?
So just to take a step back, overall, we've seen and experienced more than 132,000 reported cases of coronavirus around the globe and at least 5,000 deaths worldwide, which is really serious. But what we know now is that at the heart of this outbreak, it's moved from China now to Europe. And today, the WHO's director, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said this.
Europe has now become the epicenter of the pandemic, with more reported cases than the rest of the world combined, apart from China. More cases are now being reported every day than were reported in China at the height of its epidemic.
And so Dr. Tedros, Marco, he reiterated this multiple times so that that point was not lost, that Europe is really becoming the epicenter. You know, Italy, Spain, France are all places, Germany, that have seen a lot of cases, especially overall in Europe. There's been more than 28,000 cases reported. But also at this press conference, the WHO announced for the first time the creation of a private fund in order to raise support that people in the private sector can donate to. And it's called the COVID-19 Solidarity Response Fund because they're needing hundreds of millions of dollars to really help countries most in need of help through this spring.
That is good to hear. But that news from the WHO that there are more reported cases now than in China at the height of the coronavirus outbreak, what does that tell us about where the coronavirus is headed next?
Well, yeah, I mean, Europe has been hit really hard right now. The European Center for Disease Prevention and Control has reported at least 28,000 cases. It's really tricky to know when something like this might peak somewhere. But the thing to know is that it's really dependent on what countries do. It's about having a comprehensive approach, and that includes the contact tracing, figuring out who might have been exposed. There's also the quarantining and, of course, the social distancing that we've heard so much about. That can include things like schools being closed, sports leagues being called off, and that's happening around the globe as we speak. It's a way to really limit something like a coronavirus from spreading from one person to the next, if done, as the WHO emphasized, with a host of other measures, too. It's not a panacea.
Speaking of social distancing, Ilana, you traveled back to Boston from Europe yesterday. What was that like?
Well, it was really busy at the airport because a lot of people were scrambling to get back to the U.S. I sat next to somebody who was from Hong Kong originally, but an exchange student on spring break in Europe. And we both shared our experiences when we were in Portugal, which is where I was traveling from. We were both asked if we had been to China, but that was about it at that point. And other than that, the CDC recommends that I remain at home for 2 weeks.
The World's Ilana Gordon, thank you very much and welcome back.
Thanks, Marco.
Congress is dragging its feet with an economic response to the coronavirus. The sticking point? Paid sick leave. Democrats like New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand want more.
We want mandatory paid sick leave for up to 2 weeks. We also want paid family and medical leave, because if your child's school has shut down, you can't choose between caring for a child and getting a paycheck.
The U.S. lags behind many other developed countries on this, and as the number of COVID-19 cases goes up, those policies could impact how the virus spreads. Dr. Jody Hyman is the former dean of the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. Dr. Hyman, how does sick leave influence how an illness spreads? Is there a link, and can you make it for us?
Simply put, Americans who have sick leave stay home when they're sick, so they don't spread diseases to their coworkers as often. They don't send their children to school when they're sick, so their kids don't spread it as often. And they don't work as service providers. We know that sick leave makes it dramatically less likely that people spread disease. If you don't have sick leave, you're twice as likely to send your child to school or daycare sick. You're 1.5 times as likely, even when you feel sick yourself and are contagious, to go to work sick.
So clearly sick leave is dependent on the type of job you have. What do U.S. sick leave policies look like broadly?
So unfortunately, the situation in the United States right now is that 7 in 10 of our lowest income workers don't have a single day of paid sick leave.
Wow.
So the people who need it the most have it the least. Of food service workers, 4 out of 5 lack sick leave. 3 out of 4 childcare workers lack sick leave. This is a devastating impact on them and their families, but also to everyone they come into contact with.
How concerned are you right now about where this could lead in the United States? Let's start there.
Well, I'm very concerned about what it means this year, and it's something we have to fix for every year. We shouldn't just be fixing it temporarily in 2020. We have to fix it for every year. And there's every reason to believe we can. So the world has 193 countries. 179 of them have paid sick leave. That's 94%. It's not just the high-income countries. The United States is a complete outlier in lacking all forms of paid sick leave.
So talk about those other countries. How does sick leave actually work there? Can you point to a country that you think stands out as a model?
Well, I think the good news is there are lots of models there. But what do they have in common, the ones that are working? First, people need to know they will have leave from the very first day they're sick. We can't say you have to be sick for 5 days before you get paid. By then, infectious diseases will have spread. The second thing is we need to make sure that we have paid family leave. So if your child is sick, you're able to stay home and that child is able to stay home. Canada does this well, but many countries do it well. Australia, as an example, not only provides paid sick leave, they provide it from the very first day of illness. So all workers there can afford to take the leave they need. And I think we see some of the countries that have had the worst challenges don't provide that early sick leave. And this really is one of the most important ways we can slow this epidemic.
Dr. Jody Hyman, the director of the World Policy Analysis Center, thank you very much for explaining the sick leave part of the story to us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
The coronavirus has largely spared sub-Saharan Africa. Still, today, Kenya, Ethiopia, Sudan, and Guinea confirmed their first cases of COVID-19. Nigeria has 2 confirmed cases, but Nigerian scientists know a lot about them. The world's Halima Gikandi explains.
If you want to see what Nigeria's first COVID-19 case looks like, all you have to do is go online. In early March, Nigeria uploaded the entire genome sequence of the country's very first coronavirus case. Of course, unless you actually have a degree in biology, you probably won't be able to decipher the actual sequence itself. To most people, it just looks like a random assortment of letters. C-T-T-G, T-A-G-A-T, and so on. But for scientists like Christian Hoppe at Redeemer's University in Nigeria, these patterns of letters provide important information. Hoppe is a professor of genomics. That's the study of all of the genes in an organism. He uses a technology called genome sequencing to unravel the genetic makeup of all kinds of organisms.
It could be a plant, it could be an animal, it could be an insect, it could be human.
Genome sequencing can also determine the genetic makeup of viruses and diseases. Hoppe's lab led the effort to rapidly sequence the first coronavirus case in Nigeria, and they did it in 48 hours, which is really, really fast. Hoppe says sequencing a virus typically takes them 5 or 7 days. In the past, they might have sent a sample to labs in Europe or the U.S., which could take weeks to process.
So we were able to trace back the origin of the virus in this case, and then we also realized that it wasn't different from the viruses circulating right now in Europe.
In other words, what they found was that Nigeria's first coronavirus patient was infected in Europe, not in China. These details might seem small, but they're incredibly important for Nigerian health officials to know. At the onset of the outbreak, experts thought that Nigeria and other African countries would be vulnerable to coronavirus due to their connections with China, not with Europe. This is the type of information policymakers can use when they're trying to respond to outbreaks in real time.
It is a new concept that we brought to Africa, you know, in the wake of the 2014 Ebola outbreak. And we basically just be pushing for that and pushing open data access and pushing real-time data analysis.
Keep in mind, Nigeria borders 4 countries and regularly deals with outbreaks of other viral diseases like yellow fever, dengue fever, and currently Lassa fever. So public health officials need to know when there's an outbreak, where did it come from? Is it a new strain of an old virus or a completely different disease? Charles Rotimi is a science investigator at the National Institute of Health in the U.S. and is originally from Nigeria. He says scientists in Nigeria have been pioneers in sharing their research with public health agencies in real time during outbreaks. But scientists still face barriers in their work.
Genomic research is, just like most biomedical research, needs significant funding.
Equipment for genome sequencing is expensive, and labs need to be staffed around the clock. In 2010, Rotimi helped found the Human Hereditary and Health in Africa Project in partnership with the NIH. To date, they've trained hundreds of scientists across the continent and created a network of labs in Africa to do cutting-edge genomic research. Rotimi says it's also critical to incorporate African genetic variation to the studies of viruses and diseases.
Close to 90% of those studies have been conducted in European populations. When we try to use those findings to predict what will happen in African populations, they are much more less, less accurate.
Today, the work of scientists like Rotimi and Hoppe has inspired a new generation of young Nigerians in the field. Judith Uche Ogizie is a PhD student who works in Hoppe's lab. She told me why she's so passionate about studying genes.
You know that feeling when you have opportunity to solve a problem of this nature, especially given the peculiarities of our, you know, African environment, like, is fulfilling.
Ogizie says more countries on the continent and the world should adopt Nigeria's approach to genomic research. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
As the coronavirus spreads, it seems everyone is taking their work online, even climate protesters.
Hi.
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 17-year-old Greta Thunberg has made her Friday school strikes virtual and is asking others to follow suit.
Post a picture of yourself striking at home alone.
Or with friends and relatives.
Hundreds of people are posting photos and videos from across the globe. A small group in Kenya posted this.
What do you want?
A girl in her living room in the Netherlands added,
"Good thing that this virus is causing is that it's calling people together to come as one to find a solution and beat this virus, which is also the same thing we need to do with climate change."
And one group in Ireland patched together a virtual chant with each person in their own home.
Hey, hey.
Ho, ho.
Climate change.
It's got
to go.
For Greta Thunberg, the connection between climate change and COVID-19 is clear.
Because every crisis needs to be treated as a crisis.
Whatever your passion, don't lose sight of it now, even if you have to do it from home. You're with the world. India has confirmed its first death from COVID-19, a man who was moved from hospital to hospital, dying in transit just as his coronavirus test was being analyzed. Experts there say India's health infrastructure is not prepared for an onslaught of cases. Also a big concern, the hit India's economy could take. India's manufacturing sector is deeply connected to China, and that supply chain is seriously disrupted at the moment. The BBC's Davina Gupta, host of the show Work Life India, spoke with me about the knock-on effect for India's already flagging economy.
Well, Marco, China is sort of a vital supplier to large industries. So be it car manufacturing, be it pharmaceutical, be it electronics industry, or even solar panel industry, the raw material actually comes from China. Now, people that I've been speaking to from the industrial hub in India, especially in northern India, they say that they're heavily dependent on these raw materials. With coronavirus impact, the manufacturing base in China is not supplying enough for them. So they are left with limited options. One of them was 23-year-old Sagar, who manufactures TV. And this is what he told me.
So for the next quarter, we expect at least 10 to 15% increase in the retail prices, because already 60 to 70% of the components we are using, we are highly dependent on China.
So Sagar there, he works in the television manufacturing business. A lot of those components, as he said, comes from China. What else is being disrupted? Which industries are most vulnerable in India?
So one of the most crucial industries, Marco, is the pharma industry, which is quite critical at this moment with the health scare. Now, simple medicines like for cough, for flu, for fever, the ingredients used there, almost 85% of them come from China. So when I spoke to the pharma manufacturers here, they said that they don't have enough stocks. So the only option that they're left with is to cut down their production. And that would hamper not only employment in a country which is seeing one of the worst unemployment in four decades, but also the medicines that are required to deal with common diseases. We could look at some strain on resources there.
Yeah, undoubtedly that'll have economic and wider health consequences, not necessarily coronavirus related, but just generally, I'd imagine.
Absolutely, Marco. And for that, the Indian government has also stopped the export of certain critical medicines to other countries because they feel they should have enough stocks for their own people. The other industries, as we've been talking about, is one of the biggest is aviation. And it's also the time when families are planning the vacation and holidays. But tour operators that I've been speaking to have said that the bookings have dropped by almost 50%. That has a direct impact on the aviation industry and also the hotel industry and the services industry.
So let's bring this to a human level, Davina. What happens to workers who we can easily imagine would get laid off in India through all of this?
If you look at it, these are people who work on daily wages and they really don't have much of social protection. So if they're laid off, it brings a larger question of not only unemployment, which is really high in the country, but also how much government resources can be spared to help them, to feed them, to shelter them beyond a point. It's an emergency where we're looking at one of the worst economic phases in the Indian economy. So it seems that if the situation worsens for the poorest of the poor, for people who are daily wage workers, and if they are laid off, this is a news that would be a very difficult time to deal with for their families and for them.
Davina Gupta, host of the BBC program Work Life India, speaking with us from Delhi. Thank you for being with us today. Here's a recent conversation I had that is not about the coronavirus. In fact, it was with someone who jokes for a living, Egyptian satirist Bassem Youssef, who's been finding a new life on American comedy stages. He left Egypt because over the years he made one too many leaders angry, starting with the current one, President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. He also angered Mohamed Morsi before him, and before Morsi, Hosni Mubarak, who was overthrown during the 2011 Arab Spring and who died last month. Bassem did not seem very torn up about Mubarak's passing.
The guy died in the age of 91 years old. He had a full life. He was like a demigod for 30 years of his life. For me, the Hosni Mubarak was dead since 2011. You know, I mean, I was actually surprised he's still alive.
Well, Hosni Mubarak does come up in your most recent show, Bassem Youssef. Let's hear.
And I remember my American friend telling me, oh my God, you had the president for 30 years? I said, yes. In the Middle East, that is a very short first term. I mean, that is much better than what you guys have here in America. Look at you, wanting to change your president every 4 years, like swiping left on Tinder. I need a new president, I need a new president. That is why you are empty from the inside. You have too much choice, you have too much anxiety. We have no choice, we have no anxiety, we have nothing. We enjoy long-term relationship with our dictators.
30 years is a very short first term. So, Bassem, what do you think the next generations of Egyptians will read about Hosni Mubarak in their history books?
People don't read history books anymore. I think people just get their information from the internet. That's not a joke because, you see, when I was growing up, my source of information is the kind of history books that I would have in school, right? I studied and I believe what was told to me. You know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s. We just like used internet for random porn. But otherwise, this is the beauty about what is happening in the world right now. You might think that you are indoctrinating your generations, but people will have their way to find the truth on their own. So in the history book, they can say whatever they want about Hosni Mubarak in school in Egypt. But at the end of the day, the guy was a dictator. The guy died at 91 years old. You wouldn't even, like half of us will not even live to that age. And then half of them will say, oh, he was a good man. We really miss him. And this is the same people who miss George W. Bush because they have seen Donald Trump.
So, as you say, Egyptians are now ruled by another authoritarian, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. And in your most recent show, you contrast Egypt's political system with what you've been seeing in the U.S.
Democracy is a very expensive lifestyle. Last presidential campaign, you guys spent $10 billion to get a president. Can you imagine? $10 billion. And you ended up with this. $10 billion for this?
So, Bassem Youssef, your point is a good one here. It's expensive in this country to buy a ticket to the democracy game. So, the thing that made you who you were in Egypt, the thing you satirized, dysfunctional authoritarian politics, that disappeared when you moved to the States in 2014 or so. Or did it? Do you see where I'm going with this?
Well, the thing is, at the end of the day, I'm a performer and an entertainer. Satirizing and attacking the government and making fun of the government. What made me big in Egypt is that I was basically the first and the only one who did that. Now, when I come here to the United States, and I'm speaking to you honestly and openly and practically, you know, we have every other show is someone who's doing the thing that I was doing in Egypt that was very new. But here, it's an established art, and you have huge names. All of these people who have been satirizing and attacking the government. So me as an immigrant, I cannot come and recreate myself in the same way. I'm an immigrant, I'm new to this country, and I have to find my space. I don't think that the media scene in America was waiting for an Egyptian to come from his country to teach Americans about how they can deal with an authoritarian regime, right? For them, it is different. They have their own people, right? And I think it wouldn't be that easy. So what I did was I had to reinvent myself in a different way. That's why I do the comedy, the one-man show. I'm telling my story. And through that story, I show people what I've been through and I give them examples of what they're going through.
And it is a story we still want to hear. Bassem Youssef, comedian and writer. His most recent book is Revolution for Dummies, Laughing Through the Arab Spring. Thanks for being with us, Bassem.
Thank you so much.
You're with the world. The European Union wants to pay migrants to go back home. The French have a new economic stimulus plan, more cafes. And while COVID-19 has the rest of us panic buying, many in Lebanon are taking things in stride. They've been through worse.
This is part of the problem for the Lebanese, usually. They adapt. They adapt well to misery.
The story is still ahead on The World. On Lesbos and a few other Greek islands, tens of thousands of people are stuck in limbo. They're from Syria, Afghanistan, North Africa, and elsewhere. But the European Union has an idea. It's offering migrants cash payments to go back home, about $2,200 each. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou met some of the most recent arrivals on Lesbos and has our story.
Escala Sigamineas is this picturesque fishing village. The population is about 100 people. But recently, there have been some new arrivals. They're migrants and refugees. They got here by sea from Turkey after the government there opened its border late last month. To get to the place where they're being held, I take a dirt road overlooking the water. I see two white tents with UNHCR printed on them. That's the UN Refugee Agency.
Yes, us.
At first, Greek police tell me I'm not allowed to talk to any migrants here. Eventually, though, they let me through to the makeshift camp. Clothes are drying in the sun, hanging from tree branches. Little kids are running around. Grown-ups are sitting, talking. Most of these people are Afghan. Some are Congolese. There are a couple Syrians. All of them got here through Turkey a little more than a week ago.
We are the last boat to reach this island.
Ali is 18 years old. He was on the last boat because Turkey is no longer letting migrants cross by sea. So Ali and his group, there are 42 of them, are living here in tents. He only wants to use his first name because he worries about his chances of getting asylum. And he probably should. The Greek government says it's no longer taking asylum applications, at least for now.
I know that it's very, very bad situation, but what I can do? Because I'm from Syria, if you know. My country not safe.
Yeah.
And everyone in this world, he know that how many people every day in killing in Syria.
What part of Syria?
Aleppo.
Ali fled Aleppo with his family 4 years ago. They've been living in Turkey since then. And he says life there was unbearable.
I am in Turkey. Every day I die.
He did some day labor. He worked in a shoe factory, but making a living was difficult. And he says he got no help from the government.
My dream is to go to Europe to make life there, not in Turkey.
So when 2 weeks ago, Ali got a call from a friend, another Syrian in Turkey, telling him the border's open, he was shocked and intrigued.
I not believe first because, you know, that many times I heard that the border it's open. Yes. He told me, if you don't trust me, you can open that news. Then they talk. And I open, I see that Erdogan, he talk about that border is open. And I try and I come to Greece.
Ali and his friend found out the Turkish government was busing people to the border for free. They hopped on that same night and arrived early the next morning.
And I saw many, 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 many people. Even I don't see these people never in my life in the border. 100 group going, 100 group coming, one pass going, one pass coming. I don't know. Really, I was shocked.
You might have seen these scenes on social media. Thousands of people trying to get across the border fence into Greece. Violent clashes broke out between the two sides. Ali says Greek police were using tear gas, dogs, even guns to stop people from crossing. At one point, he saw one Syrian guy trying to make it through and getting sent back.
And I asked him, what happened with you? And he told me, if you love to be in this life, if you love God, don't go this way.
So Ali decided to try another route. He went to the coast and got on a boat. This island, Lesbos, is just a few miles from Turkey. But the journey is treacherous. Ali says it started out okay, until they made it to Greek waters and saw a Coast Guard boat.
First, I see him, I get happy, because I think that it will help us. But it doesn't happen this.
Ali says the Greek Coast Guard told them to go back, fired into the air, then into the water. Then they tried to prevent the boat Ali was on from going any further.
He make big women's.
Big waves.
Waves. Sorry.
It's okay. On purpose to make you.
Yeah. He tried. He don't stop.
The boat started to tip.
And I told to myself, I say to bye-bye to my life.
But they made it here, to Lesbos. Ali and the others have been at this temporary camp for more than a week. He says his mom, brothers and sisters are still in Turkey. His dad made it all the way to Germany. He's been there a little while now. Ali says his goal is to get there, to see his dad. But he knows that won't be easy. Hundreds of other migrants who arrived by boat here earlier this month are being held on a Navy ship in a different part of the island. I tried to visit, but authorities wouldn't let me. Aid groups say those people are not being allowed to apply for asylum. They're considered to have entered the country illegally and are being treated as detainees. But Ali says he's not giving up hope. One day, everything will be okay, he tells me, and I'll be just one more person living in Europe. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou, Lesbos, Greece.
You may have heard the phrase universal basic income. Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang made it central to his campaign. His plan, every American adult would get $1,000 a month from the government.
This would create millions of jobs, make our children and families stronger, and give all Americans a better chance to transition in the economy of the 21st century. It's not left, it's not right, it's forward.
Up in Canada, this idea, just giving people money, is not theoretical. In Ontario, around 4,000 low-income people were offered fixed payments, no strings attached, $17,000 Canadian dollars a year for individuals, or around $13,000 in the U.S. The pilot project was supposed to last 3 years, but it didn't make it to the end. Still, researchers learned a lot from the trial. A team at McMaster and Ryerson University studied it. Wayne Luchik was on the team. He's an economist at McMaster University.
The pilot was a great success. Their health improved, their general health and their mental health improved, their outlook on life improved, and really quite surprising to us, the largest improvements were reported by those who were actually working before the pilot, not those who are on welfare, although everybody gained, but those who were working before the pilot gained even more than those who are simply on welfare payments before the pilot.
One assumption about a universal basic income is that people would stop working once they received that money, but that's not what you found, right?
You know, to be frank, that's nonsense. That's kind of a mean-spirited view of workers and individuals, that if you give them a little bit, they'll just sit around and, I don't know, put their feet up and watch the hockey games. Part of what this did is it gave people a floor, a minimum, below which they couldn't fall. And as a result of that, they were able to take initiatives that without that floor they were unwilling to take. So things like changing jobs, they could take the chance to go back to school and improve their skills. About a third of them moved to jobs that paid a higher wage, that offered better working conditions, that had better long-term prospects.
Yeah, I mean, just knowing you've got that stability, I'm wondering what the actual health impacts are of this program, both mental and physical.
One of the interesting things was people adopted better lifestyles. So people smoked less and they drank less. And, you know, smoking and drinking in some ways, these are coping mechanisms when things are not going well in your life. You know, another thing that people reported, they could actually pay for their prescription drugs rather than not taking them at all or skimping and only taking half of the recommended dose. And again, that's got to be good for people's health.
The universal basic income pilot project was canceled by the government of Ontario when the Conservatives came to power. One of their criticisms seems to be that universal basic income worked well for these couple of thousand people, but there are 2 million people living in poverty in the province. Isn't that a valid criticism? And is the program scalable?
This was not a hugely expensive program, to be very honest with you. The payments to individuals is about 15 to 20% more than what we provide under our existing welfare scheme. And so there would be some added costs, but also there's some added benefits. So what we saw is a reduction in hospital visits, very expensive. Here we have a public health system, and so that comes out of the taxpayer's dollar. We saw people moving into better jobs. They'd be paying more taxes, so that's got to be beneficial. So in some ways, this is a bit of a redistribution program. But, you know, the Canadian economy has been booming along until last week, and there's no real reason why we couldn't afford this.
Wayne Luchik, an economics professor at McMaster University. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
One other note on Canada. Today we're learning that heads of state are not immune to the coronavirus. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his wife, Sophie Gregoire Trudeau, are in self-isolation for the next 2 weeks. She tested positive after showing mild flu-like symptoms upon returning from a trip to London. Trudeau addressed reporters outside the government-owned guest house where the family is staying.
I want to be clear. I have no symptoms, and I'm feeling good. And technology allows me to work from home. Of course, it's an inconvenience and somewhat frustrating, We are all social beings, after all. But we have to do this.
And in Brazil, there are conflicting reports. Brazilian media reported this morning that President Jair Bolsonaro tested positive for COVID-19. Bolsonaro responded, "You've got the wrong guy." On social media, he said the report was fake news. He says he tested negative. The country of Lebanon was already sinking into an economic crisis, but now it's also facing an outbreak of COVID-19. Lebanon has now reported nearly 80 cases of infection and 3 people have died. Those numbers are expected to rise. Rebecca Collard has our story from Beirut.
Lebanon announced new travel restrictions on Wednesday in response to the coronavirus. Stuff flew off the shelves at supermarkets here in Beirut. Water, toilet paper, pasta, even dairy products. By Thursday, the shelves were restocked, but this is a worrisome sign for a country where pretty much everything is imported: food, medicine, and medical supplies. Dr. Abraham Haddad is an orthopedic surgeon. He's come to the supermarket in gloves and a face mask to stock up on his essentials.
Especially since I don't want to come often here because of corona, I bring everything I need for a long time.
Haddad is picking up canned tuna, soda water, juice, and instant coffee. He says Lebanon has good doctors and a relatively strong health system, but it's under strain already.
All the equipment we need, needle, Entranil for the serum, everything, the price are increasing.
Do you think that, like, because of the financial crisis, Lebanon is in a less good position to deal with corona than it would have been 6 months ago?
Yes, yes. We have two close crises, so it's really, really sad for this beautiful country.
The big demonstrations that began here last fall are on hold for now, but protesters say they're not done. They see the government's slow response to the coronavirus as another example of why things need to change. And one of the protesters' most popular chants has now been reworked into a hand-washing jingle.
Ela, 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 oh.
Be a good citizen and wash your hands properly is the message. Lebanon has now canceled flights and is urging citizens in infected countries to come home now or face a travel ban. And sterilization crews in white suits are spraying public areas with disinfectant. The government even announced it will boost the speed of Lebanon's notoriously slow internet, just to encourage people to stay home. Schools and universities, they're closed too.
I am in Jumeidi, which is a main street of Beirut. Usually it's lots of restaurants and coffee shops are open here. It's a pretty busy district, but right now most things are closed and very, very few people are on the street. The odd car you can hear is going by, but for the most part, people are not going out. People are staying home. And the people I'm passing on the street, many of them are wearing masks.
Some here are wondering why flights from Iran were not halted sooner. They say the Lebanese government and the powerful Hezbollah movement care more about Iran than the health of Lebanese citizens. Passengers arriving from abroad this week say there were few precautions at the Beirut airport. At the same time, just like other countries, panic is being fueled by misinformation and rumors.
Most likely the country is going to go into full comprehensive shutdown.
This voice note that circulated on social media was said to be sent from a doctor to a friend. Its contents are unverified, but it's probably been making people more nervous.
So absolutely, please don't go out. Don't leave your house. Don't do anything unless you absolutely have to.
Back at the supermarket, not everyone is panicking. Sami Shisha and his wife say people are overreacting. Their shopping cart is filled with water, imported diapers, and wipes.
We grew up in the war generation, so we can accommodate and adapt.
I think this is
part of the problem of the Lebanese, usually. They adapt. They adapt well to misery, and they adapt well to corruption.
Shisha says he's unhappy with the inflation and price gouging that started long before the coronavirus came to Lebanon. He says the government needs to step in and do more at this moment of double crisis. Because what's clear is that neither COVID-19 or the economic crisis is likely to go away anytime soon. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
They've been out in the streets protesting on and off for more than a year in France. They've even got a nickname, Yellow Vests.
The problems in French society we are seeing right now actually existed for a long time.
Gabriel Attal is the French Minister for Youth. He told the BBC last week that people in certain areas of France feel abandoned. That's why they've joined the Yellow Vest protests. But he says the government of President Emmanuel Macron has a solution.
The main response for President Macron, for the government, is work.
And that includes work in France's celebrated cafes. One of the largest NGOs in Europe is part of a plan to reopen 1,000 cafes in France over the next few years. The first ones are opening soon. Anita Elash reports from a village near the Loire Valley that's getting a new cafe.
The village of Les Grands is home to about 500 people, and it's got all the charm the French countryside can offer. Quaint yellow stone houses look out across rolling green farmland and a tiny church. A local guard dog greets me as I walk up to the village library. On a Saturday morning, it's really the only place to meet people here. Philippe Biot is the town mayor. He introduces me to three local women who've come to tell me about life in Les Grands.
Bonjour, madame.
Bonjour, madame.
In the old days, they say, the cafe just down the street was the place to meet up, to chat with neighbors and get the latest gossip. For a while, it was the only business in town, but it closed more than a year ago. Since then, Les Grands has become a very sad place to live, says Hélène Mariage. She's a housewife with a sick husband at home.
Pour nous, le café, c'est un point de rencontre.
Mariage says the cafe was not just a meeting place to catch up on the latest news. It was essential, she says, because now she hardly sees her neighbors at all. Yvonne Antor is a widow. She's lived here for 41 years.
Je vais me promener. Je suis souvent seule.
I go out for walks, and I'm usually the only one on the street, Antor says. The village is deserted. Like so many others, Les Grands Café was the victim of a changing economy. As jobs in rural France disappeared over the years, villages like this became bedroom communities for young families looking for affordable housing. Mayor Biot says that means it's hard to keep businesses open.
Oui, ça a rajeuni, avec des besoins différents.
The population is younger and has different needs. Most work in the city, and when they drive home, they're tired and don't necessarily go straight to the cafe.
In fact, more than three quarters of all cafes in France have closed in recent years. Most villages have no commercial activity, and that's brought a profound sense of dissatisfaction. Claudia Senek studies the economics of happiness. She says cafes were once an essential part of the French social fabric.
You go to a cafe in the morning to have your first coffee. You meet with friends. You have maybe lunch. This creates the feeling of belonging to a local community network, which is very important for human beings.
In a recent study, Senek and her colleagues found that losing a cafe or a grocery store makes people less happy. It's equivalent, in terms of happiness, to having your salary slashed by $2,400 a year, she says.
If you feel that you're not meeting anybody during the day because there's no place that people gather, meet together, then you feel that you're just maybe left alone, left apart, abandoned.
And here's where the SOS 1000 Cafes program comes in. The idea is to address that sense of isolation, one cafe at a time. There's a political dimension here, too. The director of the NGO is a close friend of French President Emmanuel Macron. He says the project will take on all the financial risk involved in opening cafes. It will pour $170 million into cafe workers' salaries, renovations, and rent. The village council in Les Grands is delighted to be welcoming its new cafe managers.
Vous allez bien?
Oui, vous?
Allez, impeccable. Allez-y, entrez.
Merci.
With help from SOS 1000 Cafés, Romain Richard and Cassandre Douard are taking over at the cafe in Les Grands. They meet me in their new home, directly across the street from the first business they've ever run.
Moi, ce qui me plaît dans les petites communes.
Richard says they want to help restore the sense of community that brought them here, and he thinks they've got a good hook.
On aura une déco assez vintage et rockabilly.
Richard says the cafe will be an American rockabilly-style diner with pin-up girl posters and a small grocery store. Something to please everyone, he says. Le Grand's mayor promises he'll do everything he can to help the couple, but he admits there's no guarantee the reopened cafe will succeed. He says they can build it, but it's up to a new, younger generation in town to come. For The World, I'm Anita Ilache, Le Grand, France.
This week we started a little musical ritual at the end of the show, just taking a moment to relax in these unnerving times. The streets of Italy are eerily quiet with the country under virtual lockdown due to the spread of the coronavirus. But if you had been in the Tuscan city of Siena one night this week, this is what you might have heard along one small street.
Viva la nostra Siena! Viva la nostra Siena!
The residents were leaning out their windows singing Canto della Verbena, translated as "And While Siena Sleeps." It's a popular folk song, an expression of local pride in Siena, and ain't raising spirits and showing solidarity something to be proud of right now in Italy. The dog singing along in the background, perfect addition. It's not uncommon to hear Italians singing or humming arias, so not to be outdone, locals in Naples in the south, also under lockdown, are now belting out songs from their balconies. This is from one neighborhood in Naples. I'm not here to judge the singing quality. So what if the Neapolitans are not as talented as their Tuscan friends? I'm not sure I believe that anyway. Right now, praise for anyone who's got a song in their heart. What they're singing here is, people like us will never give up. You gotta do what you gotta do to get through this. It's now turned into a bit of a competition between Naples and Siena. Siena locals are planning a citywide rendition of the song, Canto della Verbena, this Sunday night at 9, from the socially distant safety of their balconies, of course.
E mentre Siena dorme, tutto tace.
Here's how Canto della Verbena is handled by the pros.
E la luna illumina la torre. Senti nel buio, sola nella pace, sommessa fonte Gaia, che canta una canzone d'amore di passione.
We leave you on that note today, but we'll be back on Monday. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. Take a deep breath, exhale, and repeat. Have a peaceful weekend.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.